Then, while still in the CIA, he helped his former boss, one-time CIA Director James Schlesinger, set up and run the U.S. Energy Department. He served on the National Foreign Intelligence Board, the senior advisory group in the intelligence community. He announced his retirement in 1979, went into consulting, and almost immediately, by his own account, began spending most of his time with Nugent Hand, traveling in the U.S. and Europe with Mr. Nugent and talking with him daily. Guy Pauker, P-A-U-K-E-R, a RAND Corporation staff member who has advised the CIA and other government agencies since the 1950s, although he denies reports that he is a career employee of the CIA. Mr. McDonald, whom he calls his good friend, unquote, once said that Mr. Pauker has long frequent personal access has long had frequent personal access to White House national security advisors, including Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Mr. Pauker went to work as a consultant to Nugent Hand after Admiral Yates introduced him to Messrs. Nugent and Hand. He, in turn, introduced them to Mr. McDonald. Mr. Pauker says he wasn't involved in any completed deals for the bank. Dale Holmgren, H-O-L-M-G-R-E-N, a former U.S. Army officer in Taiwan who became manager of flight services for Civil Air Transport, a CIA-run airline in the Far East. He then went into business in Taiwan. He opened the Nugent Hand branch in Taipei in 1978 as a one-man representative. Admiral Yates once said that Mr. Holmgren had long worked with the U.S. military in Taiwan to develop, quote, within the social structure of the Chinese in Taipei, a close relationship with the U.S. military forces and the business and government community, unquote. Admiral Yates also said that Mr. Holmgren had worked for Nugent Hand without pay at least for a while because he had an independent income. Robert Red Jansen, a former CIA station chief in Bangkok, who advised Thai governments through almost daily meetings with the prime minister in the early 1970s, according to persons close to them. He worked for Nugent Hand there in 1978, although he apparently severed his relationship that year, according to a colleague, because he was warned by the U.S. Embassy that his presence at the bank had aroused suspicion. Mr. Jansen apparently has an unlisted number and couldn't be reached for comment. And before we go back to review some of the machinations that Nugent Hand was involved in, I'd like to read you one other short section of another article in that very same edition of the Wall Street Journal. This again from the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, August 24th, 1982, the first article in a fine three-part series run on the 24th, 5th, and 6th of August of 1982. The article is by Wall Street Journal writer Jonathan Quitney, K-W-I-T-N-Y, whose work we've used before, and it's headlined, Australian Mystery, The Collapse of Nugent Hand Bank Discloses Links with Some High-Ranking American Military and Intelligence Officials. And there's a person whose name here crops up in connection with Nugent Hand, who we're going to be looking at considerably greater length this coming Sunday in connection with the Contragate Iran affair, at which, as Nip indicated earlier, drug smuggling on the part of our government is a central issue. Reading from Quitney's article from 8/24/82. When Vice President George Bush visited Australia this April, that would have been April of 82, Labor Party leader Bill Hayden, a strong possibility to become Prime Minister, used his 30-minute meeting with Mr. Bush mostly to press for the release of details on the Nugent Hand and Whitlam affairs. Mr. Bush only gave his assurances that the CIA wasn't involved in either matter. Mr. Bush was the CIA director in 1976, succeeding Mr. Colby, who later was to become a lawyer for Nugent Hand. So George Bush, during his tenure as director of the CIA, was one of the CIA directors to whom or under whom does the Nugent Hand Bank operated. Remember now that Nugent Hand, although nominally a naval intelligence operation, also served as a major element in the CIA's arsenal in Southeast Asia. Now again, the major points of this bank are as follows. This was a bank which was set up as a U.S. intelligence operation. As indicated in Penny LaNew's book, although it was nominally a naval intelligence operation, it also worked very, very closely with the CIA. Now, in that capacity, the Nugent Hand Bank served as a broker for the CIA's drug deals. Those drug deals, remember, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 24, the first program in this series, went in considerable measure to finance anti-communist mercenaries in the Vietnam War. Okay, we took a look at the Hmong tribesmen, we took a look at the security operation in Saigon proper, both financed primarily by the dope trade. And obviously many of the people involved in Nugent Hand were not only some of the CIA officials in Thailand and Vietnam, but also notice the preponderance of China lobby people as well. We looked at the evolution of the China lobby, our wartime alliance with Tai Li and the Green Gang of Tu Yuesheng, how that eventually gave rise to CIA Kuomintang cooperation in establishing the Golden Triangle heroin area, growing area, or opium growing area in the first place. Perhaps most significantly, in addition to serving as a bank for the, as a repository for the drug money that the CIA was generating in order to finance covert operations, Nugenhand also served to finance arms deals. And the chief name that we want to take note of in connection with these arms deals and the operation of Nugenhand in general, Edwin Wilson, who along with Frank Turple not only helped train and arm Muammar Gaddafi's terrorist cadre themselves, but also obviously have had their fingers in just about every manure pie that's hit the United States in the face in, the last 10 to 15 years. We'll be coming back to Turple and Wilson on Sunday's program in connection with Irangate, Contragate. We've already looked at him in connection with a wide variety of activities.
While we're on the subject of George Bush, too, I wanted to put in a quick indicator in the margin by the name of George Bush. You notice in the article from 1982 that Dave read from the Wall Street Journal, the Jonathan Quitney article accompanying the long Who's Who, that George Bush was talking to a member of the Labour Party in Australia. This is in 1982, and assuring him that, among other things, that the CIA had nothing to do with the downfall of the Whitlam government. Interestingly enough, the fall of the Whitlam government was completed in 1975. George Bush, of course, was DCIA, director of the CIA, in 75 and 76. So, as happened today, again, December 3rd, when this show is being aired originally, George Bush flatly denied his involvement in the Contra arms deals as well as the Contra drug dealing today in a national interview. Bear in mind, in 1982, he was flatly denying the CIA's proven involvement with the fall of the Whitlam government during his tenure as director of the CIA. So again, this is something coming up this Sunday that good old George Bush is probably going to be coming under some surveillance as well as Ed Wilson and the others.
Now, not only did the Nugenhand Bank, and again, the point can't be overemphasized that this was specifically a U.S. intelligence operation set up in large measure to bankroll the CIA's drug profits. It was also used to broker CIA arms deals around the world, and perhaps most significantly, as just touched on by Nip Tuck, the Nugenhand Bank was used as an element in the destabilization of the Whitlam government in Australia. The government of not only a nation not hostile to the U.S., but of a U.S. military ally, Australia, was systematically destabilized and removed, one of the central elements, as indicated by Penny Larneau in this Australian coup, in effect, was the Nugenhand Bank. And again, some of the key names to remember, Edwin Wilson, Henry Kissinger, that long list of Army and CIA brass and Navy brass that we looked at a little earlier. And again, remembering that this is essentially an outgrowth of our policy in Southeast Asia, where we saw the U.S. take a page from the French's book and begin financing operations through the dope trade. And here we have an organization set up in large measure as a dope-financed covert operations hub, I guess you could say. And, again, remember the people involved in this. Remember that this bank, in essence, a criminal enterprise, was a U.S. government operation.
All right. And as we're going to come back and postmortem a little bit more on Nugenhand and also begin to follow the actual trail of CIA-sponsored drugs into the United States, we hope you will stick with us. Meanwhile, we're going to take a break to give everybody a chance to get up and move around and Dave and myself a chance to rest the vocal cords. And then we will return with, as I said, more information on the drug trade itself and a more specific look at how some of the drugs come into the country and who brings them in. Okay, so don't go away. We'll be back with more of One Step Beyond. Not One Step Beyond. Excuse me. Tonight it's Radio Free America. As you heard last, we were talking at great length, of course, about the Nugenhand Bank, the bank set up apparently by CIA and military officials to launder drug profits, to be paymaster for various Asian operations of the CIA and other American organizations, to work for the Task Force 157 group headed up by Henry Kissinger under the auspices of the Office of Naval Intelligence, and also apparently to receive money garnered in other ways, the drug trade among them, and launder them for purposes many of which we will just have to wonder about, and we may never find out, and probably never would have found out if Frank Nugen, the man who was one of the founders of the bank, hadn't died in a way still not explained in his car by the side of the road one day in Australia in 1980.
So again, this was an operation set up not only in order to bank the CIA's drug profits, but in turn to use those proceeds to finance further operations. Sort of a self-perpetuating CIA and naval intelligence dope operation in considerable measure. And again, the arms trafficking side, the drug trafficking side, and the overthrow of the Whitlam government are front and center here. Remember also the Edwin Wilson connection and the impressive variety of military and U.S. military and intelligence officials who intersect with this bank at one area or in one area or another. We're now going to take a look at another U.S. operation, a U.S. covert operation, which was in essence a drug dealing operation. And in turn, the proceeds from those drug deals were used not only to finance the arms trade, but to destabilize another government friendly to the United States. This U.S. intelligence operation we're going to be looking at takes place in Mexico, and this operation, and again, this is a dope-dealing operation run, in essence, by the U.S. government, was used to destabilize the Echeverria government in Mexico.
All right. The segment we're going to read to you is from a truly fine book called The Great Heroin Coup, subtitled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. We used this a great deal on the broadcast. It was sort of the next step up from the book we quoted from at great length last week, which was The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy. This was the next step, and this was where the picture began to emerge that not only was the CIA involved in the drug trade and various other parts of the government involved in the drug trade, but that it was not merely for the sake of convenience, but in fact it was as a specific way of financing covert operations. And that's what we're going to begin to be talking about in this part of the broadcast. Anyway, The Great Heroin Coup, Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism by Heinrich Krüger, a Danish journalist. And the book is copyright 1980 by South End Press of Boston.
Has a fine foreword, by the way, by Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, himself one of the premier researchers in this field and someone whose work we use frequently.
Absolutely. All right, reading from The Great Heroin Coup. They're talking now about the Mexican heroin traffic and the fact that the traffic of Mexican heroin traffic was controlled at the time of this writing, in 1980, largely by seven Mexican families. And they start off with one that's very important to our point of view, although in fact, as you will see, it's not really a Mexican family at all. Alberto Sicilia Falcón, the last name is spelled Sicilia-Falcón, like Falcon. Alberto Sicilia Falcón, leader of the Sicilia Falcons, is not a Mexican at all. He was born in Matanzas, Cuba. He and his family left the island immediately after Castro's takeover to become part of Miami's Cuban exile milieu. After the Bay of Pigs invasion, he was trained by the CIA at Fort Jackson for Operation 40. From there, his trail is faint for several years. However, according to Mexican police, he was in Chile helping the CIA to undermine the government of Salvador Allende. In mid-1973, he turned up in Mexico, where in record time, he established a gigantic heroin and marijuana ring. According to DEA Director Peter Benzinger, in 1975, the ring numbered more than 1,600, including film stars and international businessmen. Sicilia Falcón himself resided in villas in Tijuana and San Diego. Heroin was transported to San Diego from a warehouse in Culiacán, marijuana from a processing plant in Mexicali to a U.S. distribution center in Coronado Cays. In late 1973, one of Sicilia Falcón's truckers was stopped on his way back to Mexico. The truck was loaded with arms bound for Nicaragua. According to a later report in the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, one illegal weapons dealer in Brownsville, Texas alone supplied Sicilia Falcón with 12 million rounds of ammunition in 1974. The guns for drugs traffic proceeded unhindered until early 1975, when the government of then-President Luis Echeverria discovered that Sicilia Falcón's weapon shipments went to groups in Mexico. Quote, "External forces are attempting to destabilize our country," said Echeverria in a 1975 speech, in obvious reference to his neighbor to the north. Then the Mexicans began an intense surveillance of Sicilia Falcón, who, they learned, often met and conversed by telephone with a mystery man in Cuernavaca, some 90 kilometers south of Mexico City. When a lemonade bottle bearing the man's fingerprints was sent to the FBI, the Bureau informed Mexican authorities that the man was Sam Giancana, the Chicago Mafia capo, heroin trafficker, and CIA collaborator. The Mexicans agreed to a French extradition request for Giancana, but when his Paris-bound plane stopped over in Houston, Giancana was whisked away by U.S. agents. Soon thereafter, he was found murdered in his Chicago mansion. Mexican Interior Ministry officials claimed the CIA had done all it could to prevent the mobster's extradition.
Continuing with Krueger's account, on July 2, 1975, Cecilia Falcone was arrested. Under rough interrogation, he claimed to be an agent of the CIA and said that his drug ring had been set up on orders from and with the support of the agency. Repeating that last sentence again. On July 2, 1975, Cecilia Falcone was arrested. Under rough interrogation, he claimed to be an agent of the CIA and said that his drug ring had been set up on orders from and with the support of the agency. Part of his profits were to go towards the purchase of weapons and ammunition for distribution throughout Central America for the destabilization of undesirable governments. If true, U.S. heroin addicts were again footing the bill for clandestine paramilitary operations and anti-communist terror campaigns. And Cecilia Falcone and his syndicate associates were not short of funds. In his possession, police found two Swiss bank books to the tune of $260 million. Still, the strange testimony of Alberto Cecilia Falcone did not end with his confession. His family's heroin and arms shipments continued, and on April 26, 1976, he and three of his lieutenants escaped from Lecumberri prison through an electrically lit, 100-yard-long tunnel dug from outside. They were recaptured 3 days later, at which time Cecilia Falcone, fearing for his life at the hands of the CIA, requested transfer to another prison and additional security. Echeverria and Cecilia Falcone each were right about the destabilization program. FBI documents released later disclosed that between 1970 and 1976, the FBI served as a secret link between the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City and the U.S. Border Patrol in California and Texas in order to destabilize the government of President Echeverria. J. Edgar Hoover had believed that Echeverria had surrounded himself with, quote, old communists and Communist Party sympathizers, unquote. A memo from Hoover to the U.S. legal attaché praises the detonation of strategic and effective bombs in Mexico City, unquote, and the wave of night machine gunnings to divide subversive leaders, unquote. Besides Echeverria's progressive attitude, another reason for U.S. hostility towards his government was the Mexican president's refusal to approve World Bank and International Monetary Fund plans for the exploitation of Mexico's newly discovered oil reserves. The first order of business of his successor, José López Portillo, in 1976, was approval of those same plans. And the newspaper El Sol de México wrote shortly after the latter's inauguration that year, quote, "The new government is not interested in publicity regarding the Cecilia Falcone case. It will quietly extradite him to the U.S. as soon as the new extradition agreement between the two countries comes into effect," unquote. In the Cecilia Falcone case, the DEA and CIA struggled bitterly against one another. It was symptomatic of a split within the DEA's own ranks, a split rooted in the effective control of its narcotics intelligence division by transplanted agents of the CIA. And this split within the DEA is something we're going to be going into in the third program in our series. However, now we're going to take a couple of minutes just to review the Cecilia Falcone connection for you.
All right. Well, as mentioned here, Alberto Cecilia Falcone was a leading member of the Mexican heroin traffic. And in fact, when he himself was involved in the traffic at the same time, he was also involved with a transshipment of large amounts of arms. Now, as we said before, one of the main reasons that the government, the CIA and other aspects of the American government in particular, but probably many other governments as well, have gotten involved in the drug traffic is because it's an easily transportable source of revenue. And in many cases, it's also the same people are also involved with the international illegal arms shipment market. So it makes it very easy to move these back and forth. So Alberto Cecilio Falcone, not only being one of the leading drug dealers in heroin and marijuana, also was found to be moving guns backwards down the pipeline back into Mexico and Central America. And when discovered, he explained that, in fact, his drug network, his entire network, was set up with the permission and the aid of the CIA for the purpose of funding destabilization attempts on various governments. And as it turned out, one of the governments that was being destabilized was, as they protested at the time to a chorus of rude catcalls from the United States government was in fact the Echeverria government of Mexico, who J. Edgar Hoover, among other people, found to be full of quote-unquote communist sympathizers. So again, we have the situation, as we have seen many other times, as we just saw with Gough Whitlam's Labor Party in Australia, of the United States not only using illicit drug traffic to supply CIA and other intelligence activities, but using that illicit drug traffic to in fact destabilize friendly governments of allies. One has to wonder at this point if there is any limit to the depths to which these people will sink in the pursuit of their particular political goals. And as, again, bringing this up to the present day, as we see the unraveling of the, quote, Irangate slash Contragate case, and we see the thieves hurrying around to rat on each other, as is beginning to happen, making deals right and left, we will begin to see, well, we've already begun to see, the outlines of a similar type of operation on a much larger scale that are beginning to come clear.
And again, in the interrelationship between the arms trade and the symbiotic relationship between the arms and drugs traffic in the Cecilia Falcone ring, and in turn, the use of the profits derived from the guns and drugs to destabilize other governments. And in this case, the destabilization of the Echeverria government, in certain respects, recalls the destabilization of the Gough Whitlam government, involving in considerable measure the Nugan Hand Bank. Now, for about the next roughly 2 hours of our program, what we're going to be doing is, in essence, dipping back into our own archives. What we're going to be talking about the next 2 hours concerns an arms for drugs ring, which, again, was a U.S. intelligence operation almost exclusively. And that arms for drugs ring is called STIBAM, STIBAM. We covered STIBAM in Radio Free America show number 20, the fourth in our five programs done in May of 1986 about Italian politics, Italian covert politics, and in particular, the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 1981. On this evening's broadcast, we're going to recap and recapitulate a roughly 2 hours or so of the most important material about STIBAM for two reasons. Not only is it very important in the context of the current discussion, the use of the drug trade in order to finance covert operations and the interrelationship between the drug trade and the arms trade that our national security apparatus operates the one to finance the other in considerable measure, but in particular, a couple of details, several important details, of the STIBAM arms for drugs ring at this point appear to be pointing in exactly the same direction as the Contragate Irangate situation. We don't know yet whether the two will eventually hook up, but it's beginning to look that way. And we're going to recap the STIBAM material not only because it's very important in terms of our present context, but it appears to point in the direction of Irangate hyphen Contragate. And again, Irangate Contragate is something that it at bottom appears to also involve the interrelationship of the arms trade and drug trade and involvement in the drug trade by our national security establishment. That's one of the elements front and center in the STIBAM arms for drugs ring. And what we're going to be doing now is recapping recapping a section of Radio Free America number 20, this from May. Actually, this was May 22nd, 1986. And this will last us roughly the next couple of hours or so.
This article is from the San Francisco Examiner for Thursday, November 25th, 1982. It's headlined, "Biggest," in quotes, "Arms Ring Busted." Subheaded, "Italian Swapped Copters, Tanks for Heroin." Dateline, Varese, Italy. UPI Wire story. Investigators cracked what was called, quote, "the world's biggest illegal arms trafficking organization," that sent millions of weapons to the Middle East in return for heroin and other drugs. Judge Carlo Palermo, in charge of the investigation, said yesterday that the arms the organization sent to various Middle East countries included helicopters, German Leopard tanks, and machine guns. I should just mention that a little later on the broadcast, we'll find out that there were weapons even more impressive than Leopard tanks and helicopters involved. Continuing the article, in return, the Milan-based organization brought into Italy heroin and other drugs through agents in Turkey and other Middle East countries, the judge said. He said most of the drugs went to northern Europe, but some also went to southern Italy and Sicily, where the mafia runs a multi-million dollar racket smuggling drugs to the United States. Quote, "We have cracked the world's biggest illegal arms trafficking organization, which had Milan and the Middle East as its terminals," unquote, Palermo said, making another insert. When they say they had Milan, it had Milan as its headquarters, as we will find out later in the broadcast. Not only did it have Milan as its headquarters, but it had a very specific and very interesting, for our purpose, building as its headquarters in Milan. going along with the article. Quote, over a period of years, they sent millions of war weapons, including heavy tanks and helicopters, to the Middle East, for which they were paid in narcotics, unquote. The judge said 41 members of the ring have been arrested and would face trial in February. Arrest warrants have been issued against another 159 suspects, but action on these would depend on the outcome of the continuing investigation, he said. The investigation started in December 1980 as a routine check into drug running in the Milan area. A Turk named Asim Akaja reportedly gave police information that led to the discovery of 310 pounds of heroin buried in zinc packets near a villa in Bolzano and a hotel in Trento in the Alpine region of northeast Italy. But the judge said the full extent of the arms for drugs ring emerged only recently when police arrested Henry Arsan, A-R-S-A-N, age 70, a Syrian in Varese. Judge Palermo described Arsan as, quote, a big shot in the world scene of arms trafficking. Police also jailed Arsan's Italian wife, Giovanna, age 54, on charges of taking part in illegal arms and drug trafficking. From documents found in Arsan's possession, police located the headquarters of the ring in an import-export company in Milan called Stibam, S-T-I-B-A-M, Stibam International Transport. The judge gave no indication where the tanks and helicopters came from, but press reports said the gang had links with weapons manufacturers in France, West Germany, and Belgium. Okay, a couple of points to make. As we will find out, not only France, West Germany, and Belgium, but they had intense and very close and, in fact, governmental ties with arms manufacturers in the United States. Also, as mentioned before, Stibam's head offices were in Milan, as we will find out. I don't want to spoil the surprise for those of you who don't know, in a very interesting location in Milan.
Okay, and remember Henry Arsan and the name Stibam, because those are the main focuses for Psy for the rest of the broadcast. The day after the article Nip Just Read You appeared, specifically November 26, 1982, the following article appeared in the same paper, the San Francisco Examiner. On 11-26-82, the Examiner ran this story, an AP story out of Milan, under the headline, Did Big Italian Bank Finance Arms Gang? And the subhead is, Smugglers had an office in its building. It reads as follows. Italian police are investigating whether the scandal-plagued, bankrupt Banco Ambrosiano financed an international gang of arms and drug smugglers, says Italian TV. Police began questioning bank officials yesterday after it was learned that the smugglers, described by a magistrate as the largest world organization of illegal arms traffic, unquote, had an office above an Ambrosiano branch in Milan, the state TV channel RAI said. I would interrupt that that is the main branch, the headquarters of Banco Ambrosiano. Continuing, the former vice president of the Ambrosiano, Roberto Rossone, denied that the bank was involved, RAI reported. Investigators said the gang furnished Middle East countries, including Iran, with arms exported illegally from Europe and the United States. It named no other countries. Helicopters and armored cars were exported illegally in exchange for narcotics, the investigating magistrate Carlo Palermo was quoted as saying, and the drugs, mainly heroin, were then sold in Europe. Police captured the alleged head of the gang, Henry Arsan, a 70-year-old Syrian, and his Italian wife, Giovanna, 54. The magistrate said they were charged with illegal traffic of arms and narcotics. Arsan owned a hauling company that occupied offices rented from Banco Ambrosiano in Milan and served as a front for the gang, police said. Warrants are out for 200 other suspected members of the gang, including several Greeks, Turks and Yugoslavs, Palermo said. During a two-year investigation, police discovered that the gang had invested proceeds in banks in Austria, West Germany, and Switzerland. Police began working on the case in 1980 after a Lebanese Turk named Asim Akaya tipped off his brother, a police officer. Other press reports said that the smugglers were working in collaboration with the Sicilian Mafia. So, this huge arms for drug smuggling ring, and bear in mind Mehmet Ali Agha and the Grey Wolves connections to drug smuggling from that part of the world and the speculation about the Abdi Apeki murder, Arsan's arms for drugs ring, the largest illegal arms exporting operation in the world, is not only located right above Banco Ambrosiano's headquarters in Milan, but is rented from Banco Ambrosiano. It was from that the windows of that building that Roberto Calvi's secretary and the late unfortunate Alberto Della Ca sewer Well, basically, they went from the windows, whether of their own volition or somebody else's, as appears probable. We'll probably never know for sure. This same bank building, the Milan Ambrosiano headquarters, it had a office for the man named Roberto Rossone, who was shot in an assassination attempt outside those headquarters. We'll be talking about the people Abruciati and Balducci again in just a couple of minutes.
Now, again, just to solidify excuse me, some of these points here, lest anybody still out there, some Peter Pan devotee out there who still believes in fairies, would like to think that this is mere case of coincidence. Let's point out again that, as we detailed earlier in the broadcast, at the far end of this particular program, we've seen already that the far end of this particular operation, excuse me, in South and Central America, P2, International Fascista, and these other organizations are directing money from Italy, from places, specifically the Banco Ambrosiano, into phony dummy companies in South and Central America, where that money is being used to sponsor terrorism, to transport drugs into the United States in return for weapons. In other words, we've already seen that the far end of the P2 connections into South and Central America are actively involved in this guns and drug trade. At the other end, we have seen that the right-wing terrorists also involved with P2 are connected with the Falangist training camps. Out of these same Falangist operations are coming the other end of the drug smuggling. In the middle of the operation is the Banco Ambrosiano, one of the main banks that the P2 and its fascist directors were using to finance these operations in Italy and in South and Central America, and presumably some of that money was also going to get these right-wing terrorists trained in the Falangist training camps in Lebanon. And in the same main bank building of the Banco Ambrosiano, the headquarters for this entire Stibom operation just happens to be upstairs. Now, folks, I think even the most skeptical of you out there will have real difficulty stretching the bounds of coincidence to that extreme.
In fact, an article we're going to read in a few minutes concludes with a statement that this asks, the exact phrase is too many coincidences, and one of the things that they're looking at is the subject of the article Nip's about to read you, namely a number of other intersections between the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring and the Banco Ambrosiano associations, and that meaning Roberto Calvi and people around him in the P2 nexus.
Absolutely. Now we're going to read another Jonathan Marshall translation of an article that originally appeared in Corriere della Sera, the Italian newspaper, for December 31st. 1982. It's headlined A Who's Who of the Italo-Turkish Drug Trade. The Turkish bosses. I should just mention, for the rest of the broadcast, Dave and I are going to be reading a lot of Turkish names. Of all the languages that we wrestle with on this broadcast, I think Turkish is probably the most difficult for us. So any native Turkish speakers or Turkic language experts in the audience, please bear with us. We're just going to try and make them consistent, and we'll spell them whenever possible, although we won't spell all of them because there's so many.
In general, when we're dealing with foreign names on a cold read here, we have to ask your indulgence.
The Turkish bosses. The last arrest warrant signed by Judge Palermo on December 22, 1982, concerned Ismail Oflu, age 39, international smuggler, considered the king of the Turkish underworld. He had his hand in every branch of Turkish crime, especially the traffic in drugs and guns. Oflu, O-F-L-U, was for a time a refugee in Sofia, and the Turkish police asked for his extradition for a whole series of crimes, including 3 homicides. But after a few months, his tracks were lost in Holland. To Oflu are directly tied Seal Hussein, age 40, Mustafa Kisacik, age 55, and Nahik Hassan, age 60, called by Judge Palermo, quote, 3 world-class promoters of the traffic in drugs and guns who developed with a base of contacts in Sofia, Bulgaria, obviously. The 3 men are in fact heads of the 3 most powerful Turkish mafia families, which have a monopoly on the production of drugs in the Syrian border region where the poppies are grown. All 3, besides, are friends and partners of Henry Arsan. Remember, Henry Arsan is the main man at this point at Stibom. Now they're naming some names. Salah al-Din Wakas, W-A-K-K-A-S, represented the Turkish families in Milan. was based in a luxury apartment downtown. Many were his business contacts with Arsène, and above all with Karl Koffler, Herbert Oberhofer, and Gerlando Alberti, whom he met several times in Milan. His job, meaning Wacha's job, was to route the morphine base to Alberti, who would have it refined in Sicily. Now, Karl Koffler, one of those names mentioned, K-O-F-L-E-R, born in Trento, age 55, arrested December 1980 and driven into a corner. With his revelations, he will aid Judge Palermo to round up the ring that supplied Oberhofer the drugs found in his garden and in the vineyard in Bolzano. He was in contact with the brothers Kunz, K-U-N-Z, in Zurich. On March 7, 1981, he was found dead in his cell in Trento. Herbert Oberhofer, contractor and hotelier, age 40, ex-trafficker and for years a confidant and collaborator with the Guardia di Finanza, that's the finance police. The day, and by the way, we mentioned earlier in the broadcast, I can't remember the gentleman's name now, but one of the key members of the, I think actually the leader of the Italian Guardia di Finanza, the finance police, was a member of P2.
Giudice was the man's name, and Giudice. In fact, he was appointed by a Cardinal Poletti, who had a lot to do with getting him to where he was, and we talked about that in our second program.
The day after the discovery of the drugs at Mattarello, police found in the vineyard near Bolzano the remainder of the stock, 130 kilos of pure heroin and morphine. By the way, when they say the discovery of the drugs in Mattarello, that's the original Stiebaum arrest that we read you the article about from November of 82. 130 kilos of pure heroin and morphine were discovered in Oberhofer's vineyard near Bolzano. Arrested and held for several weeks, Oberhofer is now wanted. He had business ties with Kunz, Wacha's, and Henry Arsène. Now, the Kunz brothers. How Albert and Hans Kunz, financiers in Zurich, they were Calvi's men, tied also to Carboni's Sofint. They were supposed to have directed in Iran a load of arms from the United States and directed by Israel, acting in close contact with Arsène. And if I remember correctly, Hans Kunz was in London meeting with Calvi the day before he was found dead.
The exact chronology of Calvi's travels just before his death, I forget, but both Kunz brothers were contacted by Calvi on, I guess you could call it, Calvi's last ride.
Right, exactly. No, they were actually in London, as I recall from the stories, with Calvi. Anyway, so that's the Kunz brothers, but notice again now, the Kunz brothers in close contact with Arsène, also in close contact with Roberto Calvi, P2 member, confidant of Pope's, and chairman of the Banco Ambrosiano. Okay, so if you need to tie that knot any tighter, there's another contact right there.
It'll be tied still tighter, but also be worth noting here what happened to Karl Koffler. He was an alleged prison suicide. He managed to commit suicide by thrusting himself through the heart with a long, sharp needle. That's another one of these very suspicious suicides in connection with this case.
Gerlando Alberti of Palermo, age 55, ex-lieutenant of Luciano Ligio. Get back to Legio in a second. By 1980, Alberti had control over the entire traffic in drugs to the U.S. He was arrested thanks to the investigation of Boris Giuliano in connection with the discovery of the huge heroin refineries at Chinisi and Punta Raisi. In Milan, Alberti had ties to Wacha's through his lieutenant, Angelo Mirai. Now, Luciano Ligio was the head of Anonima Sequestri, which was a mafia kidnap gang that was also working for the right wing and involved with the strategy of tension. And what had originally begun as a program for kidnapping businessmen and holding them for ransom expanded into a program that was a part of the strategy of tension.
Now, it was through the investigation of the Anonima Sequestri with links to the mafia, to the P2, to Western intelligence. It was through this investigation that Judge Accorsio had begun, it had come across the P2 Lodge and had begun investigating the P2 Lodge. Judge Accorsio was then assassinated by the aforementioned Pierluigi Conchitelli of Ordine Nuovo and Internazionale Fascista, as we looked at last week, acting at the behest of Stefano Della Chiai.
Okay. Continuing. Domenico Balducci, mafia boss, tied to Alberti, for whom he was the Roman representative of the traffic in drugs. He was a business partner of Flavio Carboni. Again, Flavio Carboni, intimate of Michele Sindona and later partner of Roberto Calvi. Balducci was a business partner of Flavio Carboni in the Punta Volpe real estate project in Sardinia, which asked Ambrosiano for a loan of 6 billion lira. Calvi said yes, but he was blocked by his vice president Roberto Rossone, who was attacked several months later. Balducci was sought by police at the end of 1978 for having signed bank transactions of dirty money, originating in kidnappings and drugs, from which Palermo and Naples ended up in Sindona's Amancor Bank in Switzerland. He was assassinated in Rome in front of his house on 16th of October 1981. Now, it's being explained right here, so I'll go ahead. Danilo Abbruciati, killed April 26, 1982 in Milan while trying to shoot Roberto Rossone. Boss of the Roman underworld, especially drugs and extortion, former member of Anonima Sequestri, again, that's the Luciano Ligio group we were just talking about, of the Marseille gang Berenguer and Bergamelli, was in business contact with Balducci and Diotto Levi, the latter of whom was a partner of Calvi and present in Zurich at the moment of Calvi's flight. With a police record and now wanted, Diotto Levi is another key man in the connection between the Roman underworld businesses tied to Sofint and the Sicilian mafia. Skipping on down, this is still...
That'll do it.
Okay.
That refers to the next story here, that note
okay. There.
I should have crossed that out. So a couple of things to note here. Domenico Balducci and Danilo Abbruciati, as we indicated earlier, were two of the key people involved in the attempted assassination of Roberto Rossone, Banco Ambrosiano vice chairman, which took place right outside the same building where Ambrosiano was headquartered and where Stibaum was headquartered right upstairs. Now, Abbruciati affiliated with the aforementioned Anonima Sequestri, and, to make a long story short, all of these people part of the whole P2 nexus. Anonima Sequestri provided the key to the discovery of P2, as mentioned just a second ago. And it's worth reviewing here. We got Balducci, Abbruciati, Gerlando Alberti, all of them affiliated with the Mafia, with Anonima Sequestri, with the P2 complex, the Kunz brothers, Herbert Oberhofer and Karl Koffler. The last one, Karl Koffler, while in prison, and we're going to look at some more prison-related deaths in this whole complex, Karl Koffler managed to kill himself by thrusting himself through the heart with a long, sharp needle. Now, we're going to be taking a look at some more connections. Now, this, again, remember that hang on one second. Why don't you interpolate here a second while I manipulate the tapes here?
Okay. Again, the connections that are coming out now. Okay, just to make this plain for those of you who are fairly new to this stuff, we're talking about this whole operation that we already explained as being intimately involved with the Vatican Bank. The use of the Vatican Bank apparently by Archbishop Marcinkus for not only to make money but to make money many ways illegally. Aided and abetted by Roberto Calvi and Michele Sindona, we're finding out now that these same groups that Archbishop Paul Marcinkus had the Vatican Bank involved in are not only involved in these financial scandals, which were bad enough in and of themselves, but are involved in the world's biggest fascist-oriented guns for terrorism network, Stibaum. And we've seen now the net has drawn so tight as to be inescapable. There are no more coincidences. Stibaum is a direct contact, if it's not actually a direct arm of the P2, as is the Banco Ambrosiano at this point.
And it should be noted that P2 itself involves a much, much larger context involving international fascism, Western intelligence, and the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies in particular. We're going to be talking about that in connection with Stibaum a little later. Still another connection between the Banco Ambrosiano P2 complex and Stibaum is carried in the following story. Again, research credit to Ted Rubenstein, translation Jonathan Marshall. This is from the Italian news magazine L'Espresso of the issue of December 12, 1982. The headline of the article is Amid Arms and Drugs Between Sofia and Brescia. Skipping down in the article, talking about Stibaum here. Arsene comes from a noble family and was in Italy for 20 years. Undisturbed in his traffic, despite being known at the time to the DEA. Remember that? We're going to come back to it. His telephone began to spill important information. It made clear that the little old man had his hand in the international arms trade, but it didn't clarify where the arms left and where they ended up. That mosaic began to come together at the beginning of the year when police, listening in, learned a new name long known to them, Renato Gamba, last name G-A-M-B-A. An armorer with a factory in Valtrompia in the province of Brescia, Gamba was known for his production of precious small caliber, that's a valuable, it really would be a better translation, of valuable small caliber pistols and hunting rifles. Who would have ever expected someone like that to be involved in the traffic in armored cars and assault helicopters? But sure enough, one day at the beginning of summer, he left for that temple of intrigue, the Hotel Richmond in Geneva. The task assigned him by Arsene to find, for an anxiously awaiting buyer, 20 armored cars, 25 tanks, and 10 helicopters. police intercepted calls between Gamba in Geneva and Arsan in Milan. They investigated further and found some surprises. First, in the spring of 1982, new capital came to Gamba's plant. It was sent by a Milan finance house, Brugge Izar, born as an honorable maker of pottery and silver, which transformed itself within a few months under the guidance of little-known persons, suggesting that they were figureheads acting on behalf of others. By the way, Brugge Izar is B-R-O-G-G-I. The second word is I-Z-A-R. Continuing.